going to, not adjourn. We might as well. I'll tell you about that in a moment. I'm going to open the House Committee on Rural Communities. So we are not moving any bills today at all. We're going to hear some bills, but no bills will be moving. So if you're here to watch the action, we're not going to have action, but we are going to have hearings on bills and amendments. We'll talk a little bit about some amendments that are in progress, but none of them are ready on any of them. So we're going to be here a long time on Thursday because there was a snowstorm. It was a snowpocalypse, and that kind of put a dent in our work schedule and our negotiations. So we're not going to do any actions today in work session, just for people who are here for that kind of stuff. Means you got more time to negotiate. That's what that basically means.
Oh, that's dangerous.
So let's get into our first public hearing. House Bill 4015. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4015 and call Senator Johnson up. And these nice gentlemen, Director Garrett, and what are you, the chief operating officer?
Some say.
The coup is going to join us. All right. He retired already. He's not playing hoops anymore. But okay, Senator, you want to lead us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have elected with my teammates to bat last.
Okay, all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state and the Director at the Department of Administrative Services. We're here today to talk about House Bill 4015. What I'd like to do is just set the context for the committee. This is coming to you as a result of House Bill 2620 from the last session, and so I'll set a little context and a little process. Mr. Garrett would like to talk to the bill specifically, and I know that Senator Johnson will be eloquent to make us all look good. So you'll recall House Bill 2620 directed the governor to bring back a plan to this session of the legislature with recommendations on how state programs in economic and community development could align themselves with priorities that are set by regional solutions committees across the state. That's a very broad charge. The bill also required us to do public involvement and also required us to make some recommendations about how natural resource agencies can be better engaged with the work of regional solutions committees. We worked in light speed. A normal interim before short sessions was 18 months. The interim now is about 6.5 or 7 months, and so we went through a public process, produced a steering committee, did the work to bring you what is incorporated in House Bill 4015. We surveyed over 2,000 Oregonians and got their responses about how state agencies worked. We were really interested in two kind of populations of folks. What I like to say, those were folks who experience state programs out in the regions, whether they are businesses and citizens in communities, or they're what I call practitioners, city managers, community development directors, economic development district directors, those folks who receive state program to try and accomplish what they're trying to accomplish in their communities. We took as a base for doing this work the priorities that had been set in the 9 regions across the state. 11, thank you, Senator. 11 regions across the state. We used that as the backdrop, since that's what we were trying to align to. In looking at all of those priorities, we put them into categories, we being the steering committee, which was made up of both state agencies and also interested parties, both from the development community, from the environmental community, from local government. We use those to establish a number of categories of outcome that we could attempt to align and make recommendations toward. They were services to businesses. They were land availability and infrastructure finance, along with regulatory streamlining, if you will. I also want to make it clear for the committee and members of the audience that the charge within 2620 was not about changing state policy. We heard from a lot of folks when we did our public involvement a concern about, was this trying to dilute land use regulation? Was it trying to dilute regulatory regimes around the environment? That is absolutely not what this was about. It was about how we could be more responsive to the priorities that were set in regions in administering those regulations and in delivering services to folks. So the report you have has a number of recommendations about that with a fair amount of community involvement. The last thing I will say about process is that I hope the committee will take these six recommendations and consider them version 1.0. of this discussion. We did do it at a very quick clip. You will notice that the recommendations are fairly broad and at high levels. We have more discussion to have, there is no question, and get even a better and closer relationship with the regional solutions process so that we can be more responsive to those priorities. So you can expect from us a 2.0 version in 15. I know there's some discussions around this bill regarding public engagement and regarding interest group engagement in these processes that I'm pretty sure we don't have answers to right now, but we would appreciate the opportunity to come back in 15 and talk about those things further with the legislature. With that, I'll turn it over to Matt to talk about the bill itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon's Department of Transportation. It's a privilege to be here to continue our conversation on House Bill 2620. As Mr. Jordan indicated, it became the foundation upon which we jump off to engage House Bill 4015. The bill itself does several things, and I'll just quickly walk through that. First and foremost, it defines community and economic development as an effort that promotes or expands or prevents the decline of Oregon businesses and industries. It also promotes the alignment with the regional solutions objectives and the work that's being done across this great state. It seeks to better align the grant, loan, and incentive programs with community and economic development priorities developed by the regional solutions advisory committees. So in implementing that or awarding these types of grants, what you will see is state agencies will use the regional priorities in the consideration and prioritization of these grant and loan type projects here. The agencies, their discipline, regional solutions discipline and scrutinies will ensure that these projects are fully vetted, that they have cleared the environmental land use issues that Mr. Jordan spoke to. We're not lowering that bar at all. We are ensuring that we are good environmental stewards, and we will make sure that those protocols and disciplines are followed. I would submit to you that the bill itself ensures that this effort is consistent with the enabling legislation, the rules, the regulations that govern the various investment programs that we're talking about, these grants, these loans, these incentives. The bill also does something structurally. It places regional solutions in statute, speaks to its structure, its membership. You may recall, we have five state agencies that make up the regional solutions. That's the Department of Environmental Quality, Land Use, Conservation, the Department of Transportation, Housing and Community Development, and Business Oregon are the five core teams. We bring in our sister agencies and their professionals specifically to address issues that bubble up during the regional conversations. The bill also directs the natural resource agencies to develop a plan on how best they participate and engage in the regional solutions team. And it goes on to identify roughly a handful or so agencies, from ag to water resource to fish and wildlife, forestry, state lands, Dogami, and the Marine Board. How do they engage? Again, bringing their professionals to vet the various issues that we heard in our various circuit rides that Mr. Jordan spoke to as we engage this bill across the state. So finally, that's the basic construct of 4015. There are conversations in terms of notification, in terms of composition. I think those are things that will play themselves out and evolve over time, because I think it's extremely important to allow that conversation to take place within the regional solution centers here. So I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand down and take any questions, but I will defer to good Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I am also, at the request of Governor Kitzhaber, the convener for our regional solutions team. And so I think that I bring to this debate about the bill a rather unique perspective. The regional solutions process is an extraordinarily valuable process. It grew out of Oregon Solutions, which brings competing interests to the table. These are people that are sometimes completely inimical in their points of view. It brings them to the table to try to work out compromises. Again, drawing on my own bona fides, I believe that we were one of the first practical Oregon Solutions up in Columbia County, where for two decades the Great Gravel Wars had roiled on. I was one of the protagonists. We had sued each other until we glowed. And finally, the governor dispatched Greg Wolf up to visit with us and set the table with people who literally loathed each other. And working through our differences, we came to a durable solution that not only resulted in the best outcome in a land use debate, but also resulted in cemented relationships that have inured to the value of all of the protagonists and antagonists. So this Oregon Solutions, now joined by Oregon Mediation, now joined by Regional Solutions, is, I think, a unique to Oregon problem-solving methodology that we ought to celebrate and support. The bill that you have before you is a minimalist attempt to simply mention regional solutions in statute. That is very important because right now this exists largely as a concept without much underpinnings. We recognize that of the 11 districts, all of them are going to approach their problem-solving assignment in slightly different ways. We have a very robust process that brings to the table academia, government, philanthropy, the private sector, and I define private sector very broadly, and create a work plan that has been vetted through our county commissions, comes up through an advisory board, is done in public. The work plan has probably 15, 18 elements on it. We just have redone it and have expanded it into a work plan that now doesn't just capture our region but captures those regions where we might want to interact with others of the 11, the family of 11 of these regional solutions centers that are doing the same work. Coming back to the bill, I think there has been a temptation this session to try to load this bill up with more than the bill was ever intended to do. The bill was really intended to simply have the legislature acknowledge the existence of the regional solutions process. I have been assured by the governor's office and Mr. Jordan, and have no reason to doubt either one of them, that they would, during the interim, engage in a very robust process to develop public inclusion in the regional solution. I think as people have projected their imaginations onto this bill, it would be having some super committee do some sneaky stuff someplace that undermined some of our very closely held values in the state. Anything is farther from the truth. But in sitting down, I originally, as one of my two bills, colleagues, had a regional solutions bill, and we began trying to describe regional solutions in the four corners of the page, and it became way too difficult. So I assassinated my own bill and come in support of this minimalist approach to just mention it in statute and then rely on the goodwill of the governor's office and Mr. Jordan to convene the kind of robust public input that will lay out the methodology for how the regional solution units do their business. Where is their public input? Where is there room for dissent? Where is there an appeal process? Who's at the table? Who's the appointing authority? All of those things need to be worked out, and I would submit to you cannot be worked out in the short period of time that we have in front of us in this basically five-week session. And so I would respectfully request that you consider the bill as it comes before you. I think for everybody's comfort, having an amendment that speaks to the process that the governor's office and DAS will undertake to make sure that there is good public input would be a useful addition to this bill. But I think trying to draft amendments on the fly to describe how Regional Solutions does their work is a futile exercise and will result in a bill that even those of us that are extreme advocates of regional solution as a problem-solving methodology couldn't support. I would hold up to you that when regional solutions works at its best, You rebuild three schools in Vernonia and raise $40 million to do it. And so I bring that example to you to explain that when this works well, it works brilliantly. I hope that we don't get bogged down in trying to put 10 pounds worth of details in a 2-pound vessel and instead just move forward by acknowledging the legislature, acknowledging the existence of the regional solutions, relying on the governor's office and Mr. Jordan to come back and help describe a public process that will make us all proud, regardless of from what philosophical perspective one approaches the work of the regional solutions. I thank you for your consideration.
Great, thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And I don't know who the right person to ask this question to, and I appreciate the spirit with which this bill is brought forward. But it sounds like from your testimony that this is a idea in a bill form that has not had the time to fully mature. You might disagree with that phraseology, but you get the idea. We got some work to do to get this to be a full-fledged idea. Why do it now? Why not just wait until the full long session in 15 to not only put regional solutions into statute, but also give it the public process that I believe that it needs, and also make sure that we have the right groupings of representation so that we have the right voices at the table to come up with the right solutions? What's the rush to get it into statute now with the 2-pound version?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Unger, I believe it's about definition and legitimacy, if you will, regarding the overall process. And I think, as Senator Johnson has mentioned, this is a relatively benign approach to that definition, at least as a beginning. But secondly, we do have regional solutions groups, teams, committees that have real projects that they are working on. And we believe that the recommendations which drive some of the language in the bill regarding particularly the alignment of state resources around this work, these priorities, is important enough for us to get direction from this body to begin. Will we bring something back in 15? Yes, we will. There will be more work to do. There's no question about it. But there's currently work going on in the field right now where we can, as state agencies, do a better job aligning what we do with that work. And so that direction's helpful.
May I add to it?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, part of the reasons that Oregon Solutions and Regional Solutions work is this public-private partnership, the academia that is the neutral convener, philanthropy. We have, in many instances, Vernonia, one of them, gone to the private sector and asked for considerable philanthropy to move us forward, the public sector in working out some of the other little details. But I want to put a more nuanced urgency on what Mr. Jordan said. Right now, for example, we are working on a single point of permitting with the Corps of Engineers to do maintenance dredging for coastal ports. For many of these ports, down in Representative McEwen's area, for example, being able to do maintenance dredging in established port facilities where dredging has gone on for a long time is literally existential. They're silting in, and the fleets that use those ports cannot operate. We are working very hard with the Corps of Engineers to do a different kind of permitting. And if we are able in statute to recognize the existence of regional solutions in this minimalist approach, it will help us, I think, solidify the kinds of relationships that we want with our federal partners for these ongoing projects. We also are looking for private sector participation, and I would call to your attention that we dredged the Skipanon River in my district as a result of a $250,000 private sector contribution from a fish processor, simply because they could no longer get their boats in and out of the harbor. So we need something that gives us adequate legitimacy for those of us that are actively involved in the process to go to a private sector partner and say, will you write us a check?
We do this all the time. And some of them are want to look over their glasses and say, where do you exist in the government hierarchy? I'd like to at least be able to point to a place that says the legislature acknowledged the value of the process writ large, and that we're going to come back and work on some of the specifics of the detail. Where do I sit? How do I know my interests are represented? That we work on that level of detail. But absent this bill going forward, I think it has a chilling effect on some of the really urgent projects that have been undertaken. In Yamhill County, for example, and I'm pandering to you shamelessly, there is an agricultural advocacy project. As I look at the rest of the panel, there is a... it's to bring different products to market. There is a one of the projects working in the regional solutions that speaks to a housing deficit. In my district, we're working on some desperately needed safety infrastructure improvements. And I see this as just one more stop in a continuum of developing the perfect bill. Is this the absolute good outcome? No. I'd rather have a much more robust description of how regional solutions works. But I sure as hell don't want to stop the bus and the forward project that we're making, progress that we're making in some of these regions, while we try to let the perfect get in the way of the good.
I have a quick follow-up.
Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm good.
I understand that, and I appreciate it, and I do appreciate the pandering as well. Well done. I guess I'm having a hard time figuring out what gets in the way of this being successful now. We already passed a bill, right, 2620, is that the number from that created this process to begin with. The governor's in charge of the state agencies. He can direct him to do his bidding. He's the governor. And I just don't get if this already exists in statute, where does, if you're like a...
Respectfully, Mr. Chair, it doesn't exist in statute. It exists as a process that is occurring with much success. But regional solutions in no place exists as a creature of statute. And so this simply says it exists. That's it. And then in the interim, we come back and we describe the mechanics of how it functions.
What I might recommend is give us two more days and see where we're at, because there's a lot of negotiations going on as we speak, probably, or they were 10 minutes ago.
Sure.
So let's take two more days, see where we're at. It may be that we end up waiting longer, but let's just take a few more days, if that's acceptable, because we have a lot of people here on other bills, too. So, Representative Holby.
With your indulgence, I would like to ask a technical piece of the bill that I've been noodling on. I'm trying to figure out, and it's in Section 2 of the bill, and it basically directs the state agencies to make their decision about awarding monies and funds that they basically are responsible for. And it tells them that they should consider and prioritize those decisions based on whether these projects do this, this, and this, and that's at that decision's made by the regional solutions team. It is the way I'm reading the bill. And so the regional solutions team, I'm a little concerned about the makeup, not just the public participation of the makeup, but also that state government isn't represented in that decision. That bothers me a little bit, because the state has an interest in regional decisions as well, and does have, the ability to prioritize some of their money. And it looks like the power of the state to even be on this panel and weigh in on its perspective of where we need to invest our economic dollars or whatever loans and programs all our state agencies have control over is missing out of this bill. That's of great concern to me.
May I respond to that?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, as a former state agency director, albeit little bitty agency, this frankly worries me a little bit, too. I had a budget that went through a certain process to be approved and finally was voted on by the legislature, and to have something external with the possibility of queue jumping or directing me to undertake activities as an agency head that I didn't have the financial resources or the staff to do is worrisome. Again, I would submit to you that this is not a perfect bill. That is something that has been of concern to me, and I have heard from other state agency heads that it is a concern to them, that we be quite precise in describing how the regional solution priorities interface with state agency priorities. Now, again, I can only speak to my experience in my district. We have this published, robust work plan that is widely shared. I don't know what the 11 or what the other 10 do, but ours is very consistent. We also had been quite sensitive in my region about any kind of perceived or real usurpation of the prerogative of city councils or county commissioners to set priorities for what was going to happen within their jurisdictional sideboards. So I think that you are wise to point this out as something that could benefit from refinement. Nobody wants surprises. The governor has, in previous iterations, issued executive orders to ask state agencies to cooperate. For example, the Vernonia project was so huge that there was an executive order that simply said to state agencies, you will give consideration to this project as you're looking at expending your resources. But I think we want to avoid a situation where some sort of external body is able to queue jump over established plans and reprioritize the work of agencies. I'm very sensitive to the issue that you raise, and I think it's a valid one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, I completely concur with Senator Johnson. This is a valid issue, and actually it's an issue that's being discussed current time here. So I think that the bottom line, in no way are we trying to circumvent the existing discipline that is associated with these various programs here. And that's why I say the state agencies will use the regional priorities as a consideration for these programs. So we're not undercutting. We seek to comply with the enabling language at first, because again, the queue jumping is problematic. So we are having that discussion. We think we can come to some agreement here of how you use the disciplined approach that has allowed us to arrive at a regional priority. Again, with the cross-discipline approach of the individuals we've said who make up the composition here. And what we did here, and I think this is extremely important, what we heard when we were riding circuit, talking to the citizens across the state, the folks that came to the various meetings associated with House Bill 2620, direct question was asked, do you agree with the regional priorities here? And over three-quarters across the state said, yeah, they have captured that, the regional priorities as we see them. Now, again, they didn't represent everybody here, but we knew we were shooting at a target that was solid here. So, again, we won't compromise it. We're not trying to go around it. I think it's just another filter or criterion that's used as we make investments. I think it's extremely important to say that well, I'll leave it at that. The second part of your question was, where's the state sitting around the table here? Well, the state agencies are sitting around the table, and I would submit they're almost staffing the overall conversation, because I have people who sit at each and every one of the regional solution tables here, and they're informing the infrastructure side, at least the transportation infrastructure side of the conversation. And what it allows my folks to do is look across the panorama. In terms of investment here, how can we maximize the leverage of the transportation investment with other infrastructure investments? So we're not tearing up a piece of infrastructure 1 year after we went in and did some work here. We're trying to better coordinate on the outcome here. I think that's extremely important. So, Representative Holby, I would submit that you have your state agencies representing the statewide interest as well as the regional interest, because I have that responsibility both statewide and regional in terms of transportation corridors and so forth.
Thank you. Follow up. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the goal of this mission. I was involved in 2620 and getting it through the legislature as well. But I just submit that the language that's the way that language is used, to consider and prioritize, basically takes out any sort of decision making power from the contracting agencies. And I would probably argue the governor himself in making that all those decisions on how those monies will be prioritized is up to that regional solutions team. And I think as a result of that, you would find legislators coming in and trying to represent the state interest in what our priorities would be in projects, like we do a little bit already. But it would be, you know, if we want a statewide significant project that has state interest, we would be doing that ourselves. And I don't think that's the intent of this legislation, to have us micromanage the loan programs of all state agencies for the projects we think the state should be delivering on, because they're not represented in these regional teams.
Okay, any more for this panel? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me call Angela Crowley Cook, Peggy Lynch, and Jonathan Manton up. And I would also ask you three to remember, we're not doing anything today. There'll be discussions between now and then, so keep it brief, because things could change real easily later on this evening, for example.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And Peggy, you'll get to talk again the next time. I won't just do a work session.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government, and that's why we're here. When we saw 2620 last session, we saw the opportunities related around economic and community development, and we saw concerns to make sure that the citizens of Oregon knew that besides their city government and their county government, that there was now a really important regional governance structure, although during 2620 we got rid of governance out of the bill.
Yeah, right. But
it was important to have the conversation. I'm going to do a quick bit of pandering myself. We have a local league in Lane County. We have a Marion and Polk League. We have a Coos County League. And we don't have a Washington County League right now, but our Washington County members do participate in the Portland League. We have members around this state. We support the concepts around regional solutions teams as a way to encourage state agencies to work together on behalf of local needs. We're seeing an increase in interagency cooperation, and the culture of working together on behalf of Oregonians is improving. With that in mind, we are disappointed with the original language in 2015. The -2 amendments being proffered by the governor's office address one of our concerns that we have raised, and it follows with Representative Holvey's concerns, to assure that the grant and loan programs mentioned first honor the criteria set by rule or law from this body as to the purpose of those programs. If, after those criteria are met, applicants can show a nexus to a regional priority, that fact should be considered. We do have a concern about the words "and prioritize" in the bill as well, and it was not in the governor's -2s. But allowing them a check mark seems reasonable. Saying that they get the money first is problematic, and I will hand to you a copy of the latest DLCD technical grants, which shows the broad range of grants given across the state. And I don't know, I haven't had a chance to see which of those grants would have been checkmarked for regional priorities. But you need to understand that our local communities have a great many needs, and the regional priority teams may not have captured all of them in their work. So that's part of our concerns. The loss of DLCD grants for small cities, particularly on the Oregon coast, where I'm hearing from my people that they need to have their comp plans and development codes redone so that they can move from the 20th century into the 21st, is really important. Small rural communities have a variety of infrastructure needs on water and wastewater that could hold them back from flourishing. We spent millions of dollars on an interchange in Coburg. If we had simply given them a wastewater treatment plant and upgraded their water and sewer systems, they could have had housing in an urban growth boundary area for when, remember Monaco, when it actually was functioning. We could have had them have a wonderful community there. And instead, because of the lack of funding that we have for some of those projects, it didn't happen. So I'm very concerned about how we spend our infrastructure dollars. We're always interested in seeing state agency programs become more efficient and effective. As a member of the Oregon Conservation Network, we supported Natural Resource Agency budgets last session that would increase staffing for both protecting and permitting responsibilities. The League specifically testified in support of three additional DEQ members whose jobs would have been had a direct nexus to regional solutions. And the governor provided more monies, and I know, I see you looking at me and telling me to
I'm thinking about Thursday. Maybe you don't get to go again, but everybody else does.
Well, you know what? What's really important...
And you're the League of Women Voters. That's the best part of that.
Thank you. So what's really important to me is to make sure that what happens on Thursday is takes care of and is the right thing. So the second part of our concern does relate to what we just heard in the conversation about how we make regional solutions committees to be more representative, what the public process is. So I will shorten what I was going to say. So the issues that are on the dash fours do talk about also the purpose, the broader purpose of regional solutions. And that is important. I need to take care of two more issues. Mr. Garrett said that three-quarters of the people said that regional priorities were wonderful, but truth is that the unscientific survey noted that only 22% of those participating said that the priorities matched well. 52% said they matched somewhat well. And in the Portland metro area, where there were a greater number of citizens at the kitchen table survey part, they reduced that number down to 18%. So the broader, the more you have a conversation about what these priorities are, the there is a difference. I will submit to you the DLCD grants list. I will submit to you a one-pager about the 9,000 person more scientific survey related to public. And the other issue that needs to be taken care of, and this is why this may be a really important bill that you can't put off in spite of the fact that it isn't ready yet. So we've got a lot of work to do. I'm going to submit to you the LFO report from November to the Joint Ways and Means Transportation and Economic Development, because there is a $10 million infrastructure fund that is supposed to go to regional priorities. That's a good thing. We desperately need money for a number of infrastructure projects around the state, and certainly the one that Senator Johnson is working on up in her area is a safety project that needs to be addressed. But you need to have oversight. It needs not just to be an executive program that only exists under the governor's auspices. And this bill simply says, great program, Governor, you go off and do whatever. And I think I have lots more to say, but...
You can come back Thursday. It'll be great. We'll talk about this Thursday.
So, and just so you all know, I did serve on the steering committee for House Bill 2620, and I really appreciated it, and I think we ended up with a pretty good product. There's a couple of areas of contention, but we really did come up with a good product to talk about how we should address economic and community development in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Angela?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Angela Crowley-Cook, Legislative Director for Oregon Environmental Council. And to ensure that I can speak on Thursday, I will be very short. OEC supports the concept of regional solutions and was really impressed by what I heard by the first panel, the commitment to public process and to making sure that agencies aren't directed to go too far afield of what they already need to take care of. I'll touch briefly on the Dash 4 amendments. That would be sort of our ideal of where this bill could go, but we're in conversations with folks in the governor's office and other folks, so we'll keep working towards the middle ground on this. The one point that is pretty critical is the public participation process. And I participated in the online survey, but in something as important and big and comprehensive
were you
like
somewhat
this,
satisfied or very satisfied? It's anonymous.
I don't think I followed up on whether or not I was satisfied, but so with something that's this important and complicated, I think it would be good for Regional Solutions to use the public process that many other committees use. So the 60-day public notice, the opportunity for public comment, you know, since other bodies already follow this type of public process, it seems like it would be a good one for Regional Solutions as well. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon, as well as Central Oregon Land Watch. Thank you very much for having this hearing and for allowing this conversation. I very much respect and appreciate all the comments that have been made thus far. I'll also be very, very brief and just touch on 3 points on behalf of those two organizations. One would be, and you have written testimony from Water Watch, I think, before you. One would be the need to better define community and economic development in the bill. The sideboards that are proposed in the Dash 4 amendments come directly with regard to that definition from an executive order from Governor Kitzhaber, which is EO 9722. Second would be, again, what Angela just mentioned about the notice and comment and the importance of having the public process be adequate and robust. And the third would be the what was proposed in the Dash 4 with regard to including a representative of the conservation community on the advisory committees. I just want to make a statement and can assure folks kind of what the intent behind that was. It's not to try to stop economic development in any way whatsoever. It's rather to bring a perspective to those advisory committees that reflects, for example, that, you know, lots of times conservation-oriented policies do wind up in significant economic development, and there's two studies that I will bring to your attention on that. One is that was submitted to Travel Oregon in April of 2013 called The Economic Significance of Bicycle-Related Travel in Oregon. It found that there were $400 million in economic activity generated from bike tourism in 1 year, that's 2012. So that is just kind of a policy, and it understates the importance of having that perspective. And even a bigger one would be the Fish and Wildlife Study that goes back to May of 2009. And both of these were by Dean Runyon and Associates, and it's fishing, hunting, wildlife viewing, and shellfish viewing in Oregon. And it found that fish, wildlife, and recreation resulted in $2.5 billion in economic activity in 2008. So just wanted to raise those issues with you. Again, thank you for having this conversation, and look forward to talking more about it.
Okay, great. We'll see everybody Thursday. So that's it for this bill at the moment. And on my sign-up sheet, I do want to note for the record something from the Treasurer's Office. The types of programs described in this bill do not encompass investment programs managed by the State Treasurer or the Oregon Investment Council. Those are programs with clear productivity standards as objectives already described elsewhere in statute, the Constitution, and in federal law, and are not considered community and economic development programs for the purposes of House Bill 4015. That'll keep some other people off your backs. Okay, with that, nice people over there, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 4015, and I will go ahead and carry it over, and carry over House Bill 4015 to Thursday. And representatives, can you join us? Let me open a public hearing on your bill. That is House Bill 4029.
Can I have Paul Rittenack,
sure,
we join this as well?
Yeah, got him.
Sure.
And, do I hear music? Okay. Welcome. Please, Representative Kennemer, Representative Fagan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. And Mr. Chairman, committee members, appreciate the opportunity to come and provide testimony on our bill. Representative Fagan and I have introduced this legislation because there is a significant problem. It's no secret that the city of Damascus is not in compliance with its land use obligations. State statute provides 4 years to acknowledge their comprehensive plan and land use regulations. Damascus has exceeded the 4 years, or over 9 years in counting down, and landowners are trapped. Businesses can't build or expand to provide additional jobs. And Clackamas County is lagging behind in job creation, and we need to break the gridlock that is in Damascus. Let me talk about what the bill does and a little bit about what it doesn't do. The bill creates a process for deannexation, or as the bill calls it, withdrawal. It applies only to Damascus. It's been very carefully written so that it does not apply to other cities. It has bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. It allows landowners on the edge of the city to de-annex or to withdraw properties, but properties in the center of the city cannot be withdrawn. So you will not see those famous donut holes that are so often criticized. I think that was an important Maybe that wasn't a good idea.
No, that was a good one. Most of this committee likes.
No, I think for annexation purposes, we do not want donut holes. But I should have brought donut holes for the committee if I thought it through. Not got it. Oh, shoot. Well, now moving right ahead, though.
We have 100-acre donut holes, you know, in our future.
We're still letting everybody vote.
Just let me know. We'll see what we can do. It also sunsets and automatically ceases to exist as soon as Damascus meets its planning requirements. It provides a quick and straightforward process for withdrawal with a hearing and a right of appeal. It removes any barriers that would prevent a withdrawn parcel from annexing to another city. It provides shovel-ready projects with a path forward to development. Such projects are blocked right now due to Damascus inaction. And I would note, for example, in a lot of different ways, North Clackamas School District is desperate to build a new school for Damascus. There's no mechanism to allow that to occur, and they're having to meet payments on leased land in hopes of holding the substantial acreage that a school needs. The bill also provides much-needed opportunities for job growth in Clackamas County, and Representative Fagan will address that a little more specifically. It provides a strong incentive for Damascus to step up to the plate and meet its planning responsibilities. It provides withdrawal and annexation process, a gradual process that encourages Damascus to step to the plate, but ensures the process is moderate in its pace. Now, what does the bill not do? It doesn't require any property owner to withdraw. It doesn't allow any withdrawn property owner to develop urban uses in the county versus a city. So they cannot just go to the county for it. And, in fact, under Metro's Title 11, any de-annexed or withdrawn property must annex into another city to develop at an urban level. It also does not burden Clackamas County with additional urban planning, and it does not create obligations or conflict with Metro policies that confine urban uses to cities. Landowners who de-annex or withdraw must annex into a city to apply for urban uses. A fix similar to this has been before us last session in Senate Bill 708, and it almost passed the process but got caught up in some politics. So we have our new improved bill. The landowners and businesses and citizens of Damascus need our help in solving a problem, while at the same time giving the city a realistic incentive to meet its land use planning obligations. And I'd like to add one final note. We have also requested a conceptual amendment. There were concerns raised by Metro and by Clackamas County about withdrawals. That any such withdrawals have a realistic prospect for annexation to another city, since development must be done in cities. So on page 1, line 15, our conceptual amendment would read, well, first the current line reads.
And just to be clear, we'll get it as a real amendment for later.
Yes.
We're not going to actually try and...
No, we're not. Thank you. Yes, and I appreciate it. Ms. Riley had said she would
Ramona will be down here.
But I just
second.
Like... Yeah. No.
Yeah, thank you. That's good. I would like to say what we have I think, come to agreement about, because we wanted to get Metro in Clackamas County and supportive. So any portion of the track is located on the boundary of the city and within 1/2 mile of another existing city. So the addition is in within 1/2 mile of another existing city. So this does not allow all kinds of interesting withdrawals and all kinds of other game playing. I think it's very specific. And perhaps Representative Fagan would go on, and then we'll take questions. And sure. We have Attorney Riverneck here to help us if we have some questions.
Please, Representative.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51, which includes Outer Southeast Portland, Southwest Gresham, Boring, Damascus, Happy Valley, and unincorporated Clackamas County. And as someone who represents 2 different counties and 5 different cities, I take seriously my role as a person who's supposed to represent the people within there. Regardless of county lines and city lines, I represent the people. I join Representative Kenemer in sponsoring this bill because this is an opportunity for me to represent the people of Damascus. In November, the people of Damascus had an election, and they had a ballot measure to disincorporate the entire city. And the people spoke overwhelmingly with a landslide 2-to-1 margin. 63% of people said yes, disincorporate the city. Unfortunately, due to what turned out to be a triple majority requirement, that effort technically failed. However, what did not fail was the effort of the people of Damascus to express their extreme frustration at what has been going on in their community. This bill does not solve that entire problem, but it does, for the first time in nearly a decade, allow a city to begin to move forward. And critically, in the area of economic development, I was at a recent dinner with actually Representative Davis and others for Clackamas County, and a statistic just made my jaw drop when I learned that in the Tri-County area, Multnomah County is actually at 104% of pre-recession job levels. Washington County is at 114% of pre-recession job levels. Clackamas County is at 44%. So encouraging, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my reaction.
Yep.
So encouraging economic development in Clackamas County is a critical, critical need. And this is certainly not the solution to that, but it is a solution, and I certainly encourage your support.
I'm Paul Riverneck, Chair Clem, and members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have technically about how it sunsets or how it works.
Okay, any questions for this panel? Representative Vice Chair McEwen.
Thank you. I guess I am curious as to how it sunsets. Thank you very much.
All me on.
You're all
Didn't
the way here now.
Didn't say anything.
We worked hard on this.
Let me point you to lines 12 and 13 on page 1. And what it says is that page you two. Qualify as a tract to extract yourself from the city as long as the city's comprehensive plan remains unacknowledged at the time the owner applies. So as soon as the city gets its comprehensive plan approved and acknowledged by LCDC, it stops. And only if there was some pipeline case that would continue. The other sunset provision, there are two, is section 4 of the bill, and it says in 2025 this is done.
It's done.
Any further questions for this panel? Great. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was kind of all 4. So we've got a few against. I'm going to call them up, and then we'll go back to the 4s. We try to alternate between sides here. So Chris, I think it's Chris Tabor. Begins with a K. Yeah. And Jim DeYoung. And that's all I've got signed up for against. If there's somebody else here against, make yourself known. Okay, great. Chris, I've got you first. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee. There aren't too many of us against who are actually here because none of us knew about it. I learned about this yesterday. I haven't got to read the entire bill. And I really urge you to hold the writers of this bill to the public process. It's hard for me to be too prepared to say what why I don't agree to this, but basically, I think that our small, very small rural community is far better equipped than Clackamas County or the state to handle the livability. That'll help. And the development of our slopes, our buttes, our watershed and water quality, and what happens to people living downhill where hardscapes are allowed to replace nature's canopy. And it's unfortunately, development becomes hardscapes in most cases. So I just really urge you to please go through the public process of how most bills get presented and let us know about it. Yeah, there's been a lot of years and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of hours of public process just trying to become a city and to come together. We're just average citizens who have found ourselves in this situation, but we still recognize that we want to be a city and be allowed to go forward and have some input on it. And if I was kind of amused at listening to Mr. Kenemir's talk about no holes will exist, but that's not wholly true. If, as an example, Mr. Patton is allowed to de-annex, then my entire historic Clackamas River community is just left as a little dog leg attached by a little thread up to the rest of the city. We're not even, we don't have any of the same geography as the rest of the city either. So I couldn't even get to my neighbors last night to let them know that this was happening today. So that's why there's just two of us here.
So just for the record, I need to have you say your name.
Oh, my name is Chris Tabor, and I live at 17,000 Southeast Highway 224, which is bordered by the Clackamas River and the end of the... I'm just barely tucked inside Damascus in the UGB.
So for now, is that...
yeah, because
again,
We'll
be back on Thursday again on this topic. We're not passing this bill today, so you're welcome to alert people who want to send us emails or make phone calls in between now and then. You know, not that they can drive down here on Thursday either, but
right.
we do read and answer our phones and emails and whatnot.
Okay, and will I be able to have a list of that?
Yeah. Well, we can get you our emails.
Okay, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
And phone numbers.
Thank you.
So, Jim, what brings you here today?
Thank you, Chair Clem, and the rest of the committee. I appreciate your opportunity, my opportunity to speak before you. I'm Jim DeYoung, a city councilor of Damascus, and I'm also a member of the group Citizen for Moving Damascus Forward. I'm here representing, however, only myself and not the group, and the group Citizens for Moving Damascus Forward. I'm not speaking on behalf of the City Council. I'm speaking as an individual. Even though the word Damascus does not occur in House Bill 4029, it is clear that this bill is aimed solely at Damascus, since it is the only city in the state that has been incorporated between 2000 and 2005. And yet it has not forwarded to the state and LCDC a comprehensive plan for acknowledgement. Well, I can well appreciate the position of those who wish to withdraw from Damascus in order to develop property, for I, too, am a landowner in Damascus and have been so for more than 42 years. I think the proposed legislation is misconceived, contrived, and actually detrimental to the development of Damascus and the timely production of a comprehensive plan, which is the common goal of the bill, and all testify here today, I believe. And so I'd like to explain my opposition, and I have several pages of documentation here, but I will summarize it and leave copies of it behind if I may do so.
Sure, thank you.
So I'm going to skip the first issue that deals with the whole terminology involved in the bill, centered around the word withdraw. And I want to go to the second issue, and that is of authority. It seems to me that the charter gives sole authority for deannexation or withdrawal of land from the city to the city council. Where then does the state legislature derive such authority to grant withdrawal of land from the city? If it can exercise this authority, what prevents it from usurping other authority and committing other onerous actions, such as the disincorporation of a city, or the forced annexation of adjacent lands to it, or a host of other troublesome unlawful actions? If this action is pursued against Damascus, should not other cities fear that similar actions could be forced upon them based on other newly created reasons? And notice the reason for such action as stated in this bill. It is because the city has not forwarded a comprehensive plan to the state agency within a period of 4 years, as the ordinance or law stipulates. But other cities prior to the year when this regulation was implemented had no such stipulation in years. And after all is said and done, is the violation of a time period just cause to force upon a city action that violates its own charter and poses a dangerous precedent? After all, we're not talking here about some overt refusal of a city council to submit a plan or some other unlawful deed. We're dealing with the reality that Damascus was placed in the urban growth boundary without a vote of the people, that the city decided to incorporate to protect itself against the very issue this bill seeks to address, annexation to an adjoining city, that the city is composed of diverse interests that range from those who want to develop property, mainly on the west, and those who want to live for the foreseeable future in a rural area, mainly those in the east. And then it embarked on a way to get a comprehensive plan done that represents diverse and competing interests. Third, it is claimed that Damascus has experienced dysfunction in the last 10 years. This is overstatement. Damascus rejected the concept plan earlier, then incorporated in 2004. It adopted a comprehensive plan and presented it to the state on December the 14th, 2010. And it was partly acknowledged by LCDC. In the meantime, a group of people gained influence to hobble government in Damascus and to use Damascus as a lackey to challenge state land use laws, as reported in an article in the Oregonian in the year 2010. Thus, the issues in Damascus have greater depth and scope than parochial concerns. It probably is true that there are few other cities in the state who have been so targeted as Damascus has been. Let me finish the history of what has been taking place in Damascus. On December the 29th, 2010, LCDC requested more items, and the city complied on January the 29th, 2011. In 2011, the opposition group supported a citizen initiative that saw the first comprehensive plan defeated on May the 12th of 2011 by a 2-to-1 margin. Then on March 13th, 2012, this same group got an amendment to the city charter passed by citizen initiative that required all future plans that are going to the state, including LCDC or to Metro, to be first ratified by a double majority vote of the people in an election. These events have contributed greatly to the so-called dysfunction of Damascus, and it did not begin in earnest until 2010 or 2011. Thus, it has had a life of less than 4 years. Fifth, I suspect that this bill is an end run around the recent decision handed down on January the 18th, 2014 by the hearings officer appointed by LCDC to recommend to LCDC a resolution of the dispute with the city of Damascus. I attended some of the sessions held before the hearings officer in late 2013, as did the chairman, Richard Johnson, of our group, Citizens for Moving Damascus Forward. This group was granted limited party status in the hearings. Mr. Wilson recently recommended that no punitive action should be taken against Damascus, such as withholding about $300,000 in shared revenue from the state to pay back a grant from LCDC until after the May 2014 primary. On this day in May, three comprehensive plans will be voted on. First, a citizen initiative presenting the original comp plan finalized in 2013 but rejected by a majority of the council. And two others, one a revision of the comprehensive plan done by the mayor and another revision of the comp plan done by Councillor Jackman. The latter two plans will be forwarded to the May primary by a majority of the council. They are still to be finalized. So Mr. Wilson is presently recommending that no action be taken contrary to the city, lest such action galvanize the residents in a position of opposition to the state's interference. He said, quote, having the stigma of withheld funds looming over the elections would seem to make accomplishment of the required planning tasks less rather than more likely, end quote.
He did suggest that if no comprehensive plan wins in May, then LCDC should, quote, explore what actions are legally available to allow property owners, such as General Distributors, Incorporated, and Patent, to develop urban uses despite the lack of an acknowledged comprehensive plan and land use regulations, end quote. Now, I understand that LCDC has been involved in the formulation of this present bill. This suggests to me that LCDC is not content to abide by the hearings officer's recommendation. It also seems that they think that the opinion of the hearings officer about the negative effects of action taken now by LCDC is either without foundation or can be ignored. Are the supporters of this bill willing to take the chance that they may be wrong, especially if there is a better way that Mr. Wilson's words suggest, in which I want to advocate in just a moment? I go on and discuss why is an emergency clause added to the end of this bill. It's supposedly done for the preservation of the public peace, health, and safety, and therefore declares that an emergency exists and that this act takes effect on its passage. I really don't understand what kind of an emergency that may be. Last of all, is the matter of unintended consequences. This is the Achilles heel of Bill 4029. The two properties of Mr. Patton and GDI, if withdrawn, represent two of the largest parcels of commercial, residential, and industrial lands so designated in the current comprehensive and zoning plans. If these are no longer part of Damascus, the city loses significant revenue to develop the city. Thus, this legislation would decimate the city, much like the vote of November 5, 2013, to disincorporate would have done. But even more damaging is this. The withdrawal of such properties and others on the northwest side of Damascus, including a large area designated as general employment, will have dire consequences. These combined properties on the western side of Damascus represent almost half of all the land designated as industrial and general employment in the present comprehensive plan. The present plan most assuredly would be rejected by LCDC as not having zoned for enough industrial and commercial land. They would not acknowledge it. The city would have to redraw and rezone the maps and go through the entire process of recalculating densities, the billable lands inventory, open space, setbacks from streams. Virtually everything would have to be redone. Probably years would be involved. This would delay even further a new comprehensive plan from Damascus. Thus, just the opposite effect of what this bill intends would take place. Instead of having a comp plan near at hand, it would be further removed and pushed away. This is a grave, unintended consequence. And I go on and talk about other provisions in the bill that do not make sense to me, but I'll leave those for your future reading if you would like. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much. Questions for this panel?
I have one quick one.
Or something longer?
Thank you, Chair. I think I understand your point that there's lots more processes here to come. I think I also... understand where the sponsors of this bill are coming from. It's been a long time since we created this UGB expansion, and it puts a lot of pressure on the metro region to not have this part planned out and developed. It sounds like May is a big day for Damascus. May 20th, I believe, is election day. If May 20th doesn't produce a result, would a bill like this, maybe that went into effect the day after with no plan in place, would that be a reasonable compromise for your position? It sounds like you're looking for action post May 20th because you have some real options on the table there for the citizens. What if those options weren't taken up on May 21st? We said, okay, we're going to go with House Bill 4029. What would you think?
Well, let me say thank you, Representative Unger, for your question. Let me say that I think that the bill still is unsupportable. And I suggest a better way, and I didn't read that portion, it's near the end of my presentation, and that is, let's suggest that LCDC accept proposals by landowners on the western side to develop under the current comprehensive plan that is basically done. And the revision that the mayor and Mr. Jackman are doing still basically accept the comprehensive plan as it is, especially for that region. There might be the need of minor revisions. But why not suggest instead that LCDC and perhaps Metro work together to allow development of those lands now under the proposed comprehensive plan? rather than requiring or asking that they first withdraw from Damascus and take a significant tax base and the future development of Damascus away from Damascus. Let's work with the present plan, implement it on an interim timetable, and let these developers do what they want with their land. Why not come up with that as a creative solution?
Yeah, the three proposals, from what I understand, are basically the same in terms of their rights for development.
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to temporarily recess this hearing. We have another one of our colleagues here. So let me temporarily recess the public hearing on House Bill 4029 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4092. And ask Representative Benz to join us. We've got one speaker, you, so this is a good one. For time management, I should say. We value public process, but I'm definitely going to go over 5 o'clock, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. I am State Representative Cliff Benz, District 60, which, of course, is Lake County, or part of it, Harney County, Malheur County, Baker County, and Grant County. You should have in your packets a copy of HB 4092, which is completely replaced with the Dash 1 amendment, which Harrison drew up for us. Today he's here in case you have questions about the nature of the changes in 4092. Many of you may recognize 4092 since the version pre-amendment was passed across the floor of the House 53-7 just a few short months ago. It then made its way to the Senate, where, like many good things, it died. And we're back, or I'm back. In your packet, I want you to, of course, look at the sheet of paper. It looks like this. And this is taken from county and metro area per capita income data. And it's pulled out of the Oregon Labor Trends magazine, which we just received. And you'll note that it says Malheur County extended its decade-long streak of having the lowest per capita income in Oregon, up to 29,000 in 2012. It's decade-long streak of having the lowest per capita income. So this bill is designed to add a tool to the modest toolbox of processes that we have available in that county. The idea here, members of the committee, is that the county court would have 5 chances during the next 6 years to identify an indeterminate number of acres industrial, subject to many restrictions and many additional clarified restrictions added at the suggestion of LCDC. And I want to thank them for their help. I met with them a couple of weeks ago, and we've added in to the bill, I think, all but one of their proposals. They had proposed a 200-acre limit, which would, of course, rob us of one of the few things we have in my county, which other people don't have, and that is space. We have enormous amounts of space, and we want to use this opportunity to point at that space and say, look, we have 6 million acres in Malheur County. We would like to say, if you want 1,000 acres, we can give it to you. Now, then the argument has been, and I apologize for repeating myself from what I said 6 or 7 months ago, but the argument has been that if we were to utilize some of the land that is along the railroad, because the railroad runs through a very modest part of Malheur County, maybe 15 miles, and that area happens to also have some very good farmland in it, some not so good. But if we were to use that land, maybe 1,000 acres, maybe 500, something along that railroad, we would pick up the water and we would move it out into the desert and add back to our inventory of farmland. Water is our life out there. We're not going to, by virtue of getting something into an industrial use, suddenly quit using that water. We would be insane to do it. And so we would move the water to an area that is currently not irrigated, thus having no net loss of irrigated acres. And I apologize again, I made the same argument, like I said, back in June. This bill, I think, is improved. It has in it a series of additional definitions. For example, it defines available sites. We do have a number of small areas of industrial land already identified and properly zoned in our county, this bill would not apply if the appropriate type of area is available, and we define what available means. We also add in the fact that there must be roads, there's got to be sewer service, electricity, and water. We are blessed in that the City of Ontario has an enormous amount of available water in case we attract a business. I want to emphasize something. There's been suggestions that because we don't have already large industrial folk in Malheur County, that somehow this isn't necessary. It completely misses the point. What we're trying to do is create something we can point at and say, do you need 1,500 acres? Do you need 1,000 acres? We can get it for you, and we can get it for you quickly. That's what we're trying to add to the toolbox. Does it mean anybody will show up? I don't know. We hope. We have some people looking now at our opportunity, I'll call it, and that, you know, looks good. It's about 700 jobs. Whether it will happen or not, I don't know. And I'm happy to say LCDC is working with us with great alacrity in trying to zone an additional 300 acres that is in the urban reserve so that this opportunity isn't squandered. Happy to answer any questions. I know you've all seen this bill before. I appreciate your support.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Clem. Representative Bence, I appreciate you coming back with this bill. I remember the first time it went around, and if I do recall, you commented at that time on one of the things that was challenging for you in your district, and it had to do with the closeness of the Idaho border and the ability to compete for jobs, in essence, or industrial customers, or, because of the closeness of your neighbor. Is that still the case? And it's been a while since we've heard this, but that was kind of a driving fact at that time. Is that still part of what this issue was trying to address?
Right, Mr. Chair, Representative McEwen. Sadly, that is exactly still the case. And I had people email me, a realtor who I spoke with before I came down to the special session. I'm sorry, to the short session. And he pointed out that he had a industrial land person interested that pointed out they had the money, $20 million. They want to invest it. If they come to the Oregon side, they'll be looking at years before they can do something. If they go to the Idaho side, the instant response is, where and how can we help you? I mean, I should have put the letter in your packet. The point is, with that type of competitive framework, literally 100 yards away, it makes Malheur County incredibly challenged. I also want to point something out that it works kind of this way. Oregon's safety net is better than Idaho's, much better safety nets. And as a result, my three small communities on the Oregon side of the Snake River act as a magnet to low-income folks. And so we end up with a very high population of low-income people in Malheur County because it's better on the Oregon side if you're low-income than the Idaho side. A good example, of course, is the minimum wage. Ours is $2 an hour higher on the Oregon side. So, and there are other examples. But I would simply say that we seem to attract the low-income folks, and we seem to lose the jobs we would love to have to employ them. It's really sad. And so this is one tool, one thing that might be used. We put a 5-time limit on it, a 6-year sunset, and many other restrictions.
Other questions? Thank you, Representative Bence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 4092, reopen our, come back out of a temporary suspension of our, I'm trying to find the number, House Bill 4029, reopen House Bill 4029. And let me get Steve Meisinger, Judith Fick, and that's That's Diana H.E. something. Helm.
Sure.
And then, do you know what he is? No, it doesn't matter. Steve, please.
Chairman Clem and members of the committee, I'm Steve Meisinger, the general manager of General Distributors, Inc. My business address is 13895 First Street, Oregon City, Oregon, 97045. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 40029. GDI owns 23 acres of land in the city of Damascus, and we wish to build a new center of operations for our business. Our project is shovel-ready, and we need to be finalized now because our business is bursting at the seams. After 5 years of working with Damascus, we still can't get land use filed for application of our property. And we have spent huge number of hours in and out of meetings and discussing with people to get this done. And so, as we already know, Damascus had 4 years to get it in place. They've been after it for better than 9 years. We have 125 employees and a $19 million worth of annual economic impact. We can grow these numbers with a new facility, but we need help. We need House Bill 4029. We've asked Damascus twice to let us de-annex so we can plan through another jurisdiction. We've asked LCDC for help, but their enforcement order, they indicate they don't have the power to force Damascus to do any planning. General supports enactment of a rational solution to the lack of land use processes in Damascus area. But when the City Council's best idea after 9 years is to send the voters three different comprehensive plans for consideration, we think that rationality has gone AWOL and we need to turn somewhere for help, the legislature. Providing legislative solutions now will allow economic development to move forward without further delay. Our shovel-ready project will create additional jobs without further delay. Clackamas County needs this input. Recent figures indicate that both Multnomah and Washington counties have exceeded 100% of their pre-2008 employment levels, and we're still at 44%. Projects like ours will help turn these numbers around, but we have to have a way for zoning. The economic benefit flowing from our third-generation family business is significantly roughly 342 direct and indirect jobs and growing. And there will be additional construction jobs that will result from the building of necessary improvements for a new facility that will exceed 120,000 square feet for our operations. In addition, the property tax revenues from these improvements will provide revenue for local governments to provide services. These tax revenues are genuinely needed by local governments. Building a vibrant quality business requires cooperation, proactive solutions, governmental cooperation, and timely decision making. Damascus failed on all these accounts. We ask the committee to pass House Bill 4029 and end the land use planning roadblock on our land. This will allow jobs to be created and Metro's urban goals for these lands can move forward. Thank you.
And Judith?
Judy.
Yeah, Judy.
Members of the committee, my name is Judy Fick, and I'm one of the owners of General Distributors Incorporated. My business address is 13895 First Street, Oregon City, Oregon, 97045. I would like to provide each committee member with an on-the-ground view of what it's like to get approval to grow business and create jobs within the city of Damascus. General Distributors is an Oregon-based, family-owned business started over 80 years ago and is in third generation of family ownership. We currently have a payroll of approximately $9.1 million, and we provide 125 family wage jobs. Because of the nature of the beer distributorship business, General Distributors has significant indirect job inputs in the greater Clackamas County area, including 53 indirect jobs due to the purchase of goods, equipment, and services in the local economy, 151 induced jobs related to the purchase of local goods by our workers, and 18 jobs due to the capital investment. We have supported the community with over $400,000 in contributions since 2008. In 1974, we purchased our current warehouse in Oregon City, which has 60,000 square feet of space. The difference in the distribution business between 1974 and 2014 is night and day, with the advent of craft beers and the addition of wine, juice, tea, soda, and energy drinks to our portfolio.
Our business has grown more complex, and we are literally bursting at the seams at our current location, and we now need more than 120,000 square feet of space. We anticipated this growth, and in 2008, we made the significant decision to purchase 23 acres in Damascus. Prior to the purchase, we talked with Damascus officials, reviewed proposed zoning transportation infrastructure, and determined that Damascus was a place where we could build our new facility. Since 2008, General Distributor employees and my family have attended literally hundreds of planning advisory committee meetings, transportation meetings, informational meetings, planning commission meetings, and city council meetings. We have worked carefully with the City of Damascus planners, ODOT, the county, and others. 172nd Avenue was constructed specifically with our business in mind, and oversized sewage links were constructed within easy reach to our property through our efforts. Without any direction from the city, we have worked with our neighbors to address their concerns and have reached agreements where we provide access, additional setbacks, and vegetated screening on the north side of our property. Our expectation was that Damascus would follow the rules and a comprehensive plan and zoning ordinance would be in place in 2010. We envision construction of our new 120,000 square foot operation center in 2012, and we expect it to be growing our business and hiring new employees by today's date. However, petty political disputes have blocked any progress, notwithstanding the good work of staff and literally hundreds of hours of input and testimony we have given to the city processes. The law requires Damascus to have its zoning in place in 4 years, but they have now been without zoning for more than 9 years. Because the City of Damascus has failed to get zoning in place, General Distributors has been unable to build on its urban property. We are stuck in our existing warehouse. We are unable to grow and create more jobs. The Damascus City Council has worked to actively block normal zoning processes. We have petitioned the city to de-annex, as allowed by state law, so we could seek zoning through some other local government. However, our two requests have been rejected by the City Council without discussion. We are a small business but a vibrant business. We desperately need to build our new operations facilities so we can grow our business. To do this, we simply need the City of Damascus to approve a zone that's been sitting on the planners' desks for more than 5 years. LCDC has brought enforcement proceeding against Damascus, but LCDC admits that it does not have the power to compel Damascus to do any zoning. Damascus is the only place in the state of Oregon within city limits that does not have urban zoning. House Bill 4029 will let GDI get out of this nightmare and start a shovel-ready project that will create new jobs. Please pass House Bill 4029 to fix the Damascus problem. Thank you for this opportunity to talk with you.
Great. And?
Chair Klim and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Diana Helm, and my business address is 1995 Southeast Highway 212 in Damascus. I am a former member of the Damascus City Council, and I am testifying today, though, as a private citizen. And you've heard it again and again and again. Damascus was allowed 4 years to develop a comprehensive plan and zoning. It's been over 10, actually. They were incorporated 10 years ago, and they're not close. They're not even close to getting a comprehensive plan, let alone these zoning ordinances. You'll hear promises of a May election. And with three proposed plans and over 6,000 pages for the voters to look at, I don't see another plan getting passed in May. As Representative Fagan mentioned, the voters overwhelmingly don't even want to be a city. So the fact that the plan is probably not going to be passed in May as well. Politics have blocked that land use planning in Damascus for far too long. While serving on City Council for 6 years, I worked hard on creating the city's comprehensive plan. I am deeply frustrated that the current City Council cannot agree on a comprehensive plan that will allow businesses in the city to build and expand. While the politics in the City of Damascus plays out, business and property owners pay the price. Our property values are held hostage, and our tax dollars are being wasted. GDI approached the city several years ago with a beautiful plan for a distribution facility. This would be a gateway project that the City of Damascus would be proud of. GDI worked hard with the city for 5 years. Today, they cannot even file an application because the city has no plan in place. Here's where it gets kind of interesting, and I respect Councillor DeYoung's comments. I mentored him for my seat on council. Although we're at opposite ends right now, I'd like to just talk about a couple of things that he mentioned earlier. Even if the city council magically approved a plan in May, it would still be years before the zoning could probably be put in place. But more importantly, the Damascus City charter amendments have completely crippled the city. They don't allow for charges or fees of any kind, no SDCs, no building permit fees, none of the charges that help a city operate. They also don't allow for spending. So regardless of an approved comprehensive plan, they can't even move forward as a city. Those are hurdles that are insurmountable as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't matter if GDI or Patton are outside of the city, their tax monies can't be spent in the city anyway. So let's let them out. It's obvious to most of us that development will occur first on the west side of the city, where the services are currently located. This bill would allow landowners to de-annex from a failed city and promote growth and business opportunities that would benefit our community. We need to allow businesses and developers, such as GDI, the freedom to use their land to grow their business, create jobs, and build communities. House Bill 4029 will allow trapped property owners relief from the gridlock in Damascus, and I fully support this bill. And as a side note, I want to be a donut hole. Do you mind if I'm a donut hole? Because I'm not on the boundary of the city, and there are so many of us inside the city that would love to de-annex from this failed city. So let's let these guys that are on the boundary do it first, and then we'll work on that maybe next session. I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm intimately familiar with what's happening at the city level in Damascus. Otherwise, thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much. And then I've got a Mr. Lowell Patton. And that's the end of my list. I don't know which camp you're in, but you got it all to yourself, so it doesn't matter. We try to align the fors and against with each other, but you're our last speaker, so tell us your name and then what you'd like us to know.
And I can take as long as I want.
Probably not, because we have a bunch of other people here on one more bill in 25 minutes. You seem like a nice guy, though, so I'll give you a little latitude.
My name is Lowell Patton, Mr. Chairman, members of your committee. I think I've been suffering longer than anybody else in this room. We had a sawmill in the area. It's been there since 1948. That's 66 years ago. I only went there in 1971. So I've only been involved directly in Carver area, which is now part of Damascus, but in the Carver area for some 43 years with this sawmill. And then 2 years after, in 1973, I purchased some additional property adjacent to the sawmill with the idea in mind that ultimately, it would be developed. Well, today we have all of the services there. We have the sewer is there. In fact, I have a sewer pump station on my own property. As you heard earlier, the North Clackamas School District has an option on 9 acres. It's paid for, ready to build a school. But they're too blocked, just like I have been for years. I think if you listen to Councilman DeYoung, he pretty much made our case for us. He showed you what kind of a frustrating situation exists in Damascus, and there is absolutely no way clear to get out of it. It's, we like dental distributors testified, we've tried to de-annex that with getting 3-3 and somebody abstaining or somebody not present or something, so it went through this de-annexation process. We had the mayor was in favor of our de-annexation, but we had Councilman DeYoung and some others against it, and consequently, what do they want us for? I don't know. Sure, my taxes went up 20% just to support Damascus when they were when the city was formed. But I can't expand. I'm like general distributors. I can't do anything more with my property than is already there. Consequently, although I guess they had a strawberry farm on part of it at one time, and now there's a farmer raising some vegetables, waiting. I think he's raising vegetables where the school's going to be, but anyway, it's some use, but not urban use. And of course, when LCDC first came into being and established the urban growth boundary, they came to my fence line and followed it and left my sawmill and zoned it. It was when zoning came in, that was zoned rural industrial, and the rest of the land was farm forest. And many people in the city of Damascus would like to have it remain farm forest, and nothing happened to it, but they're not paying the taxes on it. They're not doing anything except holding me hostage. They thought when they formed a city that they would no longer be dictated to by LCDC or by Metro, that they're going to be their own boss and do as they please, because that's the only reason they formed the city in the first place, was to keep Metro out. And they found out finally that they really can't do that, and the state's got maybe a little bit more horsepower than the city of Damascus. But that's where we are. And when they formed the city, of course, I didn't even know about it until the night before the election, because there were signs up in Bel Air and other parts, but I didn't realize that it was taking in Carver and my property. And it was when I really studied the voters pamphlet, I find out I'm going into this city if this thing passes. And I think we had industrial land, which I think it was could be a violation of state law. At least it was tried in the Roseburg area and found to be a violation, that you cannot annex industrial land without the okay or permission of the owner. But it happened. I think Carver is a real jewel. It's got the Clackamas River. We've got a new bridge now across the Clackamas River. It's a ideal spot for development and a nice commercial area, and ultimately some very nice home sites, view sites and all, which you've already had testimony that some of the locals don't want. They're already there. They don't want anybody else. So anyway, the first Damascus City Council recognized my large single ownership and voted to have us put together our own master plan for that area. So I went to all of the expense of wetland studies, geotech studies, surveys, all of the contours and boundary surveys, etc., and hired a reputable land use planning company to put together all of the zoning and all, and also a first-class land use attorney. So I've had plenty of expense already trying to do what the original city council encouraged us to go ahead and do, except that the driver on that city council, of course, was a pretty knowledgeable person, and he got voted out of office, so here we are. But the line, the red line around our property, although some of the city council would like to whitewash that out, is still there. And that was an early promise, and we did the work to go ahead and develop. So, but we have nowhere to go. Like GDI already said, LCDC isn't going to do anything for us. And as far as Carver is concerned, I mean, as far as the city of Damascus is concerned, they don't care about the state land use rules. They feel that they're immune to it, and they're going to keep it the way they want, even though it's inside of the urban growth boundary. You know, any kind of sanctions don't matter. Fines don't matter. So the only thing that I can do is appeal to you, because I think that our only hope is for the state legislature to do something. And I'll be happy to answer any questions if anybody has anything.
Well, I'm going to move us along, though. That's a good tie. I don't like ties. I don't wear ties. But if I did, I'd want that tie. I'd try and buy it off you.
Well, I don't want to bribe you, but
I don't wear ties. I don't wear ties. I don't like ties. They choke me.
Yeah, where are you going with that, Clem?
Yeah, sorry. I just like the tie. Okay. Vice Chair McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Clem. Mr. Patton, do you see any other remedy for this situation that you find yourself in?
I think we've been through the mill for 10 years, and it's time that somebody does something. This is the kind of thing that the city of Damascus pulls on us. 3 or 4 months when we were supposed to have a public hearing on de-annexation.
They want to see it back there.
And I go to the city council meeting, and on the door is they've tabled it for 3 to 4 months. So instead of having... This has been going on for so long that it... It's almost criminal.
Too fast.
Hold it up,
Roll.
Hold it up.
Okay, hold up.
One more shot there.
Yeah, no, right. No.
Oh, yeah,
Representative
Davis
wants a photo. It's starting to turn into a circus up here.
Starting? Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming down and spending some time this afternoon. We'll see what we can do here. Representative Kenmer, did you want to come back up quickly and close up? Or
Chair Clem, I do have a question for Representative Kenmer.
Okay, yeah, please. I think I had that a note somewhere about that. So go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair.
It's Bill Kenner, State Representative. Thank you so much for your patience. I'm sorry this has gone so long. I think it's fairly evident what the issues are. And I'm part of the reason I'm frustrated is I was a county commissioner for 12 years in Clackamas County, and I helped get this process initiated over 15 years ago. So it's been a long time, and it's clear that it's not working, and that's why we ask you to intercede. And anything else you need to add,
Paul? Just have a couple of things. Paul Ribernick, again, for the record. I've got Ms. Tabor's property here, and I've got Mr. Patton's property, and doesn't create a donut hole. I can get a map to you if you're interested in that. I listened carefully to Mr. DeYoung. He's sincere about what he says, but he's wrong about the city charter giving the city exclusive deannexation rights. That's a matter of state statute. It's ORS 220.442. That's the statute we would be amending to allow a slightly different remedy. There's also provision in the Oregon Constitution that prevents the legislature from taking and forcing a city to do something that's against its charter, and this bill was carefully drafted by legislative council to not violate that constitutional provision. Mr. DeYoung, I think, sincerely said that the dysfunction was overstated, and I would disagree with him. He said that this LCDC had partly acknowledged the city's planning efforts. That's true. They acknowledged goal one, the public participation part. That leaves 14 goals to go. You do have dysfunction when you have a city council of seven, but there are 2-3-3 factions, and since August of 2013, they can't appoint a seventh because each faction is so concerned that the land use plan would go the other way, that they would lose. That is a classic textbook example of dysfunction. You can't get this done when your planning director resigns, great planning director, resigns on January 31st, 2014, leaving one professional planner. She's wonderful, but she doesn't have the horsepower to get this done. If you want, Mr. DeYoung mischaracterized, I think is a good way to put it, what LCDC hearings officer is. First of all, the hearings officer makes a recommendation to the commission, and that recommendation does have the languages in, but I would encourage you to read it thoroughly. The hearings officer expressed frustration that there was nothing LCDC could do, and the city attorney in the hearings before the hearings officer stood up and said, go ahead and take our $300,000 away. It really is not going to motivate us one way or the other because we can't spend it anyway. We can't spend all the money that we have because of our limitations. That is dysfunction, members of the committee.
I've got to ask you to wrap it up only because usually we don't give anybody a second bite of the apple. But you didn't talk at all the first time. You just said questions. So I let it go. Otherwise, I got to get Mr. DeYoung back
up. I have no further statements. Mr. Chairman, just one last thing. I should have mentioned that Mayor Lori DeRemer of Happy Valley was here in case there were questions, and Happy Valley is willing to cooperate if there are annexations that need to occur. So with that, I thank you so very much.
Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4029. We'll carry it over to Thursday, and so people who are interested come back on Thursday. And then let me real quickly... reopen the public hearing on House Bill. The Malheur County Bill.
4092.
And ask Peggy Lynch to come up. And we're jumping around a little because we try to get legislators in and out. And so Peggy was our other person on this bill. So let's have your testimony, please.
Thank you. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Just very quickly, we did not support House Bill 3267 in 2013, which was a similar bill. We are not comfortable with this bill as written. I have not had a chance to look at the amendments, but what I can share with you is what you have on OLIS, which I think is really important. The City of Vail has spent the last 3.5 years in amending our comp plan and expanding our UGB to include buildable industrial lands to be available. We recently filed a plan amendment, and we're hoping to have this successful and have 2 additional parcels of land available for employment. It's my understanding that Ontario has already added 200 acres of industrial lands. So I'm just saying the process works, and that I'm not sure that we need this bill to address the issues that that have been brought up by this bill. The And just for my bona fides, my my husband's paternal grandparents are buried in Vail Cemetery. I do know where this is, and Vail is a wonderful town. If you've not been there, go see their murals. They're great. But it talks about, the original bill talks on line 23 about adequate available site. What does available mean? Does it mean any site that could be in existence? So I'm not going to go any farther, but I just wanted to, I wanted you to see, yes, the city of Vail said we'd like more land, and so their testimony on OLIS sort of says, you know, give us more. My point is, however, the process seems to be working, and for the small city of Vail, the two pieces, parcels of land that they're going to add is probably a great addition to their economic development.
And you will review the amendments and let us know later what you think about those?
Sure.
Okay. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing then on House Bill
4092.
Thank you. And sorry. And let me open a public hearing on House Bill 4017. And we've got a tradition, and I almost have run afoul of letting people who are from more than 100 miles go at the top of the order. I've got one person on this list who fits that bill, so I'm going to bring up, and she's a four, so I'm going to bring up two other fours. But Linda Rollins, if you can come up, our more than 100 mile citizen, and then Dave Honeycutt. No, I don't have three, four. So I've got you two in the four category, and then we'll go to the against after this. And we're getting permission to stay longer.
So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee members may not be able to, but I'll stay here until we finish this.
I'll try and make it brief. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 4017, and specifically the dash, what I think will ultimately be the dash six amendments. They're in draft form now, but we should have them back from LC anytime soon. This is the LID bill that this committee has heard about ad nauseum, both from a informational hearing at the end of the last session, and then twice during legislative days, or maybe three times during legislative days. This bill has been a work in progress. We have had we've had meetings with the League of Oregon Cities, with the City of Portland, with the City of Wilsonville. The chair appointed a work group, and stuck Representatives Davis and Unger on that work group. We all learned a significant amount about local improvement districts as a result of those meetings. The bill in front of you has two pieces. One, a perspective piece that deals with the idea that the chair had originally asked us to do, which was to put some sideboards on the LID process. The statutes right now governing LIDs are very they don't have much meat to them. LIDs are generally left to the cities through ordinances to determine the procedural process and how an LID is formed, how many votes are needed in order to from property owners in order to agree to form the district or to remonstrate against and kill the district. All of that is pretty much left to local discretion at this point. The chair suggested, after hearing from Ms. Rollins and the story that she tells, and the essentially the hell that she's lived through, she and her family have lived through for the last few years, from in their dealings with the city of Kaiser and a developer in the Kaiser Station project, to put some sideboards in place to make sure that what happened to the Rollins didn't happen to anyone else. We attempted to do that, work through that with the original bill and subsequent amendments to that original bill, but in the end, the weight of that project in a short session is probably too much. And so the Dash 6 amendments will abandon any effort to put those sideboards on. I still hope that we can do that I know that there are other folks that are interested in that, and I believe the local government folks are willing to continue to talk with us about making sure that that happens, and we can do that in a long session in 15, where we have, where if the committee will entertain us, we'll have more time to flesh out that and do that. And I think that's important. I'm usually a big advocate for local control, and still am, but in this case, there needs to be at least a modest amount of limitation on cities and how LIDs are formed and created and imposed upon property owners in statute. There's a modest amount in California, and there's a modest amount in Idaho, and if you don't get much further in the political spectrum than Idaho and California, if they can impose some limitations statutorily, there's no reason why Oregon can't do the same thing. So we'll, on that end, we'll be back hopefully in 15 with something and continue these discussions. What the Dash 6 amendments to the bill will do, assuming, and again, I've got a draft form, but I understand we're not supposed to release draft forms. That's
no, but the fives are in OLIS, and they're somewhat close, so
yeah,
you can kind of talk about
yeah,
the concept, knowing
yeah,
that it's near the fives anyway.
Yeah. So what the sixes will do, they will apply essentially to the city of Kaiser and the Rollins situation. They apply on their face to liens created and assessments created, liens created by an LID assessment that was imposed between January 1, 2008 and January 1, 2009, to which the owner objected, and the assessment is at least twice the value of the real property. In this case, in the Kaiser case, if you recall, the final assessment was $6 million. The county assessment of the value of the property at the time of the assessment was somewhere... in the original assessment, in the pre-assessment, it was $300,000 with a $6 million proposed assessment, so essentially 20 times the value. So it has to be at least twice the value, and the amount of the assessment has to exceed the fair market, or the real market value of the property is determined by the county, by more than $1.4 million. In other words, the LID assessment has to be at least $1.4 million more than what the county says the value of the property is. I believe with those limitations, we're talking about exactly one LID assessment, and that's the LID assessment that Kaiser imposed on the Rollins family. In that situation, if you meet all of those criteria, then the way the bill works, in the pending litigation, because the city of Kaiser is attempting to foreclose on the Rollins property right now and take the Rollins property, in that litigation, rather than having the legislature decide whether the $6 million assessment was fair or unfair, you would allow a court, a judge, to make the determination of whether the assessment amount was fair or unfair. And that judge can do so based on the evidence presented to the judge. Unlike a challenge to an LID assessment under current law, where the court is limited to a substantial review or a substantial evidence standard, in this case, the judge, him or herself, would be able to look at the evidence and determine whether or not the amount of the assessment actually is equivalent to the amount of benefit that the property owner received from the improvements that were made. If the judge determines that the amount of the assessment exceeded the value of the improvements that were made, then the judge can lower that assessment amount. So if the judge says, look, I know Kaiser imposed $6 million of assessment on the Rollins property, but the Rollins really, the benefit to the property was really only $2 million. And on the other hand, although Target and Lowe's, who own more property than the Rollins family, each only paid $1 million on their assessment, while the Rollins with less property that isn't in the right in the center of the project, like Target and Lowe's, they paid $6 million. That doesn't seem fair, and it appears to me, I'm speaking as the judge, that the correct amount for the Rollins was, say, $2 million. Then the court will enter a judgment and lower the amount of the assessment to what the court finds based on all the evidence heard. You can listen to the city, you can listen to Rollins, they can listen to all their experts. The court will then, the court has the authority to lower the amount of the assessment and set the amount of the, of a fair assessment for the property. At that point, judgment will enter on behalf of the city of Kaiser for that amount. Kaiser then can then proceed to foreclose on the Rollins property, just like they can under current law. But the amount of the judgment will be representative of the fair of the benefits that the Rollins truly received, and the Rollins will have 24 months to redeem. Right now, under Oregon law, you have 12 months. The property owner has 12 months to redeem. Under these amendments, the Rollins would have 24 months to redeem, and they would redeem by paying Kaiser the amount of either the judgment that was entered by the court or the amount that Kaiser sold the property for at the foreclosure sale. And if they did either one of those two things, then the Rollins would continue to own their property. Kaiser, one way or the other, would get the value that the judge determined was the fair value for the improvements that they made. Kaiser would get that. They'd either get it by the Rollins paying it, they'd get it by a foreclosure sale with the Rollins being unable to redeem the property within 24 months, or they get it by, if there were no bidders at the foreclosure sale, then under current Oregon law, Kaiser could take control of the property and then they could market it and sell it themselves and get their money. So one way or the other, the city of Kaiser would get what a court determined was the fair market value for the improvements that they made. This is about the most modest effort that we can make to ensure that the Rollins are treated fairly through this process, and it ensures that Kaiser will get what they truly, the value of the benefits that they truly placed on the Rollins property. And right now, the county assesses the Rollins property at $2 million. So we're still $4 million short of the amount of the lien that the LID assessment that Kaiser has placed on the property. So at this point, If the legislature does nothing, Kaiser will foreclose, sell the Rollins, take the Rollins property, put it up for bid, sell it for $2 million or whatever it is. The Rollins don't have at this point the financial capacity to pay that. The Rollins will be out, and Kaiser will get the fair market value of the property. They'll do the same thing if these amendments are passed, except these give the Rollins family a fighting chance to try and find somebody. And they've been meeting with developers that are interested in developing the property to try and find somebody that can come in, work with them, redeem the property from the city of Kaiser, and then develop it. And the Rollins nightmare will finally be over after almost a decade.
So, Mrs., would you like to speak as well? If so, just say your name one more time for the record.
I'm Linda Rollins, and I just wanted to say that all we want is a fair chance to develop our property, and we've not been able to do that with that huge assessment on our property. And it's just been really hard on our family and devastating to us to lose a piece of property that we own free and clear to begin with no liens on it at all. And it's been, I just hope that you guys will help us just be able to develop that. And in turn, we hope that that's a win-win for everybody, that the city can get paid their assessment, that the courts would deem reasonable, and also that they would receive future tax revenues by whatever has been developed. And so we really want to be on the same side as the city. We just need some help from you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. Representative Thatcher.
Excuse me. A few questions came to mind as you were describing it, Dave, the amendments. One, could a judge increase the assessment, and at what point would it be determined that the value received was more than the LID assessment, meaning is it going to be determined that after right when that point in time when the improvements were completed and that final assessment was made, or is it going to be determined some like now? Because I would imagine there'd be a big disparity between the value of the property now, perhaps, and what it was then. And, yeah. Curious.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, the bill would apply if the court finds that the amount of the assessment exceeds the value received. In other words, the bill doesn't kick, the provisions of the bill don't kick in unless the court finds that the amount of the benefits that the Rawlins received is less than the current assessment. And the date that that's determined, and I apologize for, I wish these six amendments were in front of you so you could see them, the date that that determination is made is on the date that the assessment was imposed, and that was in 2008 when the value, when the market was a little bit better than it is in 2014.
And one more question. I was also thinking about my own house and how it has what I have to pay the assessor, what they've assessed, the assessed value, but then there's the market value, and back in 2005, 2006, it, there was a bigger gap than there is now. But I'm just wondering, I mean, isn't that kind of normal to have a difference between assessed value and market value?
You mean real market value is calculated by the county versus fair market value?
Yeah.
Yes. And we've heard the league question the veracity of the county assessor and say that you can't really rely on the county assessor's determination of real market value. Well, I never hear anyone complain when it's time to collect property taxes, but assuming we can't rely on the reason we chose that as opposed to fair market value is if you choose fair market value, then you end up with a battle of the appraisers, and you end up with the city hiring an appraiser, you end up with the Rawlins hiring an appraiser, you have one appraiser saying it's the value is X, the other one saying it's Y, and it turns into a battle of the experts. If you use the determination made by the county, it's clear, it's objective, we all know what it is, and we can all make that determination based on that figure.
But in these amendments in this case, we're not using real market value, are we? The judge is going to, or did we dictate what it is? I haven't seen the dash sixes, obviously, because they're not out yet myself, but...
What the court does is the court determines whether the amount of the assessment exceeded the dollar value of the special benefit to the property attributable to the local improvement on the date the assessment was imposed. So
it's not going to really get into the real market value or an appraisal value.
Well, it could, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, I would suspect that there'll be some argument in front of the court as to what that value would be, and it may turn into a battle of the appraisers.
Right.
I would hope that wouldn't be the way it is, and that's obviously not something that I'll get involved in, but that may end up being the way it turns out.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Chair Klein, my understanding is with respect to the assessor's real market value, that test applies on the first part of the bill to determine if the judge even has authority to look at the special benefit the property received. So we have a certain amount. The first part of the analysis does depend on real market value as determined in the assessment rolls by the county assessor. Then the judge will determine the special benefit received by the Rawlins property. And that is the standard that this current statute uses, that cities are supposed to impose the special benefit received by the property. That's in the statute.
Yeah, that the assessment is supposed to match up with the benefit received.
So we've got some more people to testify from the other side. Then again, we'll be back on Thursday with this, with the real amendment in front of us as well, to continue hashing through this. So do you want to ask any more here for now, or get into the next?
Maybe just
represent
that something that doesn't necessarily need to be answered now, but is there any other way you can just sit down with the city or the powers that be and work out something outside of this?
We've made many attempts to do that, and I don't know if I need to get into the details of that, but we have not been able to work with the city, and we've wanted to, because I do think we all want the same thing, and so it seems like there should be a way, but the city has not been very helpful in trying to meet in the middle on this at all.
And they're up next, and we're going to hear from them in a moment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, it's going to be a little difficult to do that right now when the city's got a summary judgment motion in their foreclosure action, and the court's going to hear that motion in March. If the city wants to withdraw their lawsuit and sit down and meet with us, we'd be happy to do that.
Your Honor, mm-hmm. Let's have their testimony first before we start negotiating.
Negotiating in a public hearing?
Not that we don't like deals, but yeah, it's a public hearing. So Shannon and Chris, and then Christine, I don't know you, but if you're still here. Christine, oh, okay. And so Aaron, can you? And that's my list for this public hearing. If there's somebody else here, I don't know about you.
No, you guys go.
Okay. So, whichever you two gentlemen would like to go first.
I got picked. Representative Clem, members of the committee, I'm Shannon Johnson, Kaiser City Attorney. Thank you for taking the time to consider Kaiser's point of view here. A couple of things, Mr. Honeycutt and Ms. Rollins' testimony, and I'm going to abbreviate this since we've all been here a bit, and most of you have heard my story, I think, and the City of Kaiser's story. The word imposed was used by Mr. Honeycutt. This could see said to be imposed, but the Rollins agreed and signed two separate times on three different contracts, agreed to pay the LID, and I'm having a hard time figuring out how that's imposed. I can tell you I've been involved in this from the very beginning in terms of negotiations. We had a negotiating session last August. The city offered to foreclose on one piece immediately so we could do something to bring down our outrageous interest costs and wait 20 months to foreclose on the other piece. That was turned down.
Can you just for a second describe that piece about the inability to foreclose when you're not the owner? Because we talked about that in my office
and,
or somewhere.
And believe me, it is nothing personal against the Rollins. They're in a tough spot. We sympathize with them. That's why the city waited 3 years to foreclose. But the reality is this is not just money to the city. For our general fund, we have to pay these bonds. This is $6 million. Every 6 months we don't make a bond call, and this portion is over $100,000 in cost. We cannot use, even if we had the money, we cannot use any funds to pay down these bonds unless they're the foreclosure proceeds. We are forced under the bond covenants to foreclose, and we simply don't have any other choice. If we just sit and wait, the interest costs are snowballing.
So to be in human terms, you can't pay the principal unless you're the owner.
No, and as every 6 months this drags out, we're probably going to miss the next bond call in May or April. I doubt even if it proceeds that we'll be able to do that because the litigation's been dragged out. For those of you, and there's only a couple of you that I wasn't able to talk to directly, in 2005, after a lot of years of planning efforts, we initiated the LID process. The Rollins property, contrary to what was said back in June, was always included. The Rollins property was not included in planning efforts because it was part of a separate section that was not planned for. But in terms of the improvements, it was included, and was included from the very beginning. The Rollins appeared, hired an attorney, objected. After due consideration, the council decided to move forward with the project. After a lot of years and a lot of investments, the Rollins filed a lawsuit, a writ of review. After negotiations between the Rollins and the developer, and also between the Rollins and the city, they signed a lease that gave them $12,500 a month for one year. 1 year and $25,000 a month thereafter with the developer Northwest National LLC, or Chuck Sides. That went forward beginning in October 2005. The project was constructed by 2008, and at the same time they entered into a settlement agreement that was signed by them and recorded against the property, in which they said they waive all objections to the LID, they agree to pay the assessments, they reserve the right to object to the final assessment after the project is done, which is based on the actual cost. In 2008, that was finished, we went forward with it, there was no objection, there was another hearing, there was no objection from the Rollins. They signed installment contracts that waived their final right, which is the right to the final assessment, because it was going to be paid by the lessee, the developer. And that's what happened. So they received, we don't know for sure, we've heard $1.7 million. My estimate was $2 million in rent. The developer also paid approximately $1.2 million in LID payments on their behalf. And now, and plus a few thousand dollars in taxes. Now, after receiving that benefit since 2005, not 2008, for 9 years approximately, they don't like the deal now because, they quit paying on the LID and we're about to foreclose. But we have no other choice. You know, it's real easy for the Rollins to get up here, but this was an investment for them. This is the Rollins Real Estate Investment Company that bought the property for $140,000 in 1994 and have collected nearly $2 million in rent and still owe the property. If the legislature goes through, I was preparing until yesterday with the original proposal, which was to void the lien. If that happened, the city would be out $6 million. The Rollins would keep their $2 million or so and keep the property. But this change doesn't really help us that much. We've spent over $100,000 in attorney fees so far. And for the legislature to attempt to change the rules in the middle of the game, and frankly in the fourth quarter, is simply unconscionable. We're going to miss our bond call as it is and spend thousands more in attorney fees. And I guess my question is, with a retroactive effect like this, how does somebody go forward and sell bonds based on that, even though this legislation is directly targeted against the city of Kaiser? How does other cities and other bondholders look at this action later? Our proposal would be to just drop this legislation. I would be more interested in talking about the sideboards prospectively, which makes sense to talk about, rather than legislation that attacks the city. The city is it's real interesting because the city is an entity. It sometimes almost feel like an insurance company. People don't like entities like governments and insurance companies. It's real easy to feel sorry for the Rollins when they come up here. But Chris and I both live in the city. There's 37,000 people that live in Kaiser, and those are the people that are going to be paying the tab if we are forced to go through with this. We don't know what that would be reduced to, by the way, under this current proposal, but I'm wondering how we're going to go back 6 years and figure out what that value is and what kind of evidence we'd have to put on and how that changes the face of that litigation. In any event, I wanted to give time for Chris Epley to speak if there's no other questions for me.
Yeah, Chris, go ahead, and we can come back to both of you, too.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Shannon really said most of what I wanted to say. I just wanted to reiterate the point. A real estate investment...
Can you say your name for the record?
I'm sorry Chris Epley, yeah. City manager of Kaiser. Just sort of reiterate, you have a case here where a real estate investment company purchased a parcel of property, made a 2,000%, conservatively, profit on that investment over a period of years. And now, after entering into a development proposal and a risk assessment, making a risk assessment, I mean, this is their job. They're a development company. They own real estate. They develop property. It's what they do. So after making a risk assessment and entering into a development proposal and that proposal goes bad, now they want the city of Kaiser, the 37,000 citizens of Kaiser, to basically provide a safety net or a buyout for them so that they don't have to suffer the risk of that investment. I am sympathetic to the Rollins. I've had a lot of conversations with them, and I wish that there was a way that we could resolve this. Unfortunately, these proceedings have been dragged out and dragged out and dragged out, and every day that goes by, every month that goes by, the citizens of Kaiser are on the hook for more and more and more money. And as a professional responsible to that city, we need to move forward. There's no way that we can stop now and postpone this for 6, 8, 10 months, a year, 2 years, because the citizens are going to be responsible for another $500,000, $1 million at the end game when these bonds have to come due. So I ask you to turn away from this folly. I'm actually kind of amazed that the pieces of the legislation that actually had meat and could be talked about in a realistic manner were basically dropped, and what's left is the piece of it that is incredibly silly. I can't imagine that we're here talking about this. But anyway,
we are going to plan to come back.
I know, and we're going to continue to talk about this
at some point.
It's going to continue to be silly. So. But anyway, with that, I'm going to turn it over.
I don't mean just on this, but I mean my plan is to continue to work on the sideboard, you know, the perspective issue as we go forward. We're just having a little bit of a hard time coming to terms all the way on that as well, which is the nature of short sessions a little bit. And I only gave the request. They weren't here, so I assigned them to it. And that was in September. So
that's how that works.
And it was right during the holidays, usually, yeah. And so, you know, it was
November interim days.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, sorry. So I gave them 2 months. That was a little short. It was Christmas and Thanksgiving. But we do want to work on that issue going forward. So, Aaron, do you want to go and then...
Chair, I'm happy if you want to ask specific questions to the City of Kaiser, or if you... I'll be really brief.
Let's go ahead, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. In looking at the Dash 5s and knowing that the Dash 6 are working off of that, first, I appreciate the recognition of the need for a little more time, and we will continue to work on the sideboards part of it prospectively. I know that Representative Davis and Representative Unger and their staffs have worked extremely hard to push us in directions that I've been hesitant to go, and I think we're getting further along in that conversation and can probably come back in 2015 with a reasonable set of sideboards. But on the Dash 5, while on its face it's directed at the specific situation it's trying to address, I have heard from bond counsel, I asked specifically this question of Harvey Rogers, who does bond counsel for the majority of the cities in the state of Oregon, and I got permission to read verbatim what he sent to me in his email. He was going to provide it in a written document, but the power went out in his building, so he has no computer. He said... this draft is an attempt to give relief to a property owner who participated in an economic development project that went sour, probably because of the Great Recession. It gives that relief at the expense of the city that financed the public improvements associated with that economic development project. That city has bonds outstanding, and enacting this bill will take away a significant source of security for those bonds. I cannot predict with certainty that there will be a significant negative impact on Oregon LID bonds or Oregon bonds generally if this is enacted. However, there could be such an effect. Moreover, it is clear that enactment of this legislation would not be a positive thing for Oregon bonds because the legislation retroactively takes away assessments that were imposed in accordance with existing law and security for bonds that were imposed in accordance with existing law. And he has more analysis related to what existing law says about how...
You can furnish us that as well.
Yeah, I will forward it on... just get it from him to send to you guys. Yeah. But so our concern is, on a statewide level, what we don't know what the ramifications to bond interest rates will be as a result of this if the bond markets see this as an ability to retroactively interfere with other assessments and other similar LID bonding, that maybe they won't say no to bonds, but they'll say it's going to cost you more, and in time that assessment will affect the property owners who are going for these local improvements because it'll be their interest rates that they're paying, and of course, as was stated by Kaiser, the citizens eventually who are on the hook. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I will be done because it's late.
Yeah, I just have one, maybe. Do you think this gentleman could come Thursday?
I can ask Mr. Rogers if he's available, but I don't know.
If he can't, the kind of question I would have is I can call him. I mean, the questions I have are, you know, he's aware this would be like giving the judge new tools versus making a decision here, and also other parts sort of irrelevant. I mean, the real issue here in many ways, I think everybody could agree, was the developer ended up not being able to pay his bills. So, you know, if we could say that developer, you know, is lost money on his deal, that's for sure. The question of how much they wanted to be a developer on that project and this LID is pretty open, given they appealed it a bunch of times, but then eventually did settle, you know, because they thought they had a way to pay for it, and then the guy didn't make his payments, and so they're out, and they're out, and he's not here. So anyway, that's part of the nature of this dilemma.
Chair Clem, I understand that. I do know that Mr. Rogers did have access to a version of the draft, five. I think. I shared that with him, and he's been trying to be responsive.
That's the kind of stuff I'd want to talk to him about if he could come anyway. Because bond counsel is certainly something that's not, and we've heard allusions to bonding, but if a real bond counselor, if that's the word, would be helpful too, I think, for most people.
No problem.
And any other questions for Aaron?
Not for Aaron.
Aaron, you can go whenever you want to. And let's Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. And I'm amazed we have this much of the committee still left at this hour. But I would pose the same question to you as I did the previous panel. They've expressed a willingness to work with the. I know we're late in the game. The fourth quarter's, you know, seconds away from the bells ringing, whatever. But is there anything that you can think of or would be willing to try to think of in the next 40 or so hours to try to hash something out? You mentioned a law that prohibits you from, that kind of forces you into the foreclosure thing. Is there something that can be done on that end to stave it off? No? Okay.
No, well, that's the bondholders, and I don't think you folks can change that, but... Representative Thatcher, Chair Clem, thank you for the question, Representative Thatcher. We'd be glad to meet with the Rollins, and we've indicated that to their legal counsel more than once. We have not had any offers from the Rollins. We don't know what to propose other than what we proposed last August. We're simply stuck. If there was some money coming in, even partial monies, we'd be willing to consider that, something to keep us steady. But we're just going down the hole. We simply can't just, I mean, and I don't mean any disrespect to Mr. Honeycutt, but the idea of just saying, well, let's just put a hold on the litigation while we can just chat about this, not at these interest rates, not at the cost that we've had over the last 3 years. That's simply not an option for us. We're glad to talk, though. We're glad to consider whatever they would like to propose.
Well, I think this is what they're proposing.
Representative Unger.
I appreciate that you're happy to talk. Does that mean that you'd be interested in reducing the amount of money that you're seeking from them? Because I think talking to them is one thing, but saying, okay, well, maybe a $6 million lien on a $300,000 piece of property, maybe that didn't really work out so well, we'll lower that down. Would you be willing to do that, or would you just talk to them to fulfill Representative Thatcher's request?
No, not at all. I mean,
be willing to come down on the amount of money that you're asking for the lien from the city.
Well, have to propose it to the city council.
Well, Representative Unger, thank you for that question. I hesitate to begin negotiations in an open session.
Yeah, right.
As I said before, I would be, you know, we'd like to have to consider anything they want to say. I do want to take the opportunity, though. We had a formal commercial appraisal done. This was a very large, and we've been told, the largest LID in the state. We didn't do this blindly. We were well advised by outside counsel and other consultants. We got a formal appraisal done of all of the properties within the LID boundary. The Rollins properties were appraised as bare ground, but with the assumption that the LID improvements were in, which were substantial improvements, that their property would be worth $7 million. That's in 2005, again. 2004, probably. Early 2005. So to say that their property was worth... Yeah, I have the tax records here. It was worth a few hundred thousand dollars. And by the way, about the same time, and we don't know for sure that it was the LID or the upzoning that their property received from the city, but their property and the RMV and the county went up like 10 times Still will underneath, unfortunately, the assessment. But the property has been greatly increased in value, and I'm sorry to hijack your question, but I wanted to get that part in.
Can I ask one other question? Is it
okay? Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So one of the other things that I heard, and I'm just interested in your perspective on this, is that some property holders weren't necessarily charged the full cost of the
yes.
LID.
Yes.
How much of a discount were they given, and would you offer that same discount to the Richmonds?
To the Rollins?
The Rollins, I'm sorry. Rollins.
Representative Unger, I'm again not in a position to make any proposals. I'm just the attorney.
Understood. What about on the first part?
With regard to the first part of the question, yes, Lowe's and Target got capped, and unfortunately, they got capped not at a percentage, but as a flat dollar amount. Because they simply, the big boys there, they don't do these projects with a question mark. They're going to start building those stores before their final assessment comes in. They're not interested in talking percentages. They have to know what that project costs them, and the project doesn't go without Lowe's and Target. So they did get, it was actually, to be exact, $1 million and $1.2 million for Lowe's.
That was their cap.
Yeah, so, yeah, that was their cap, $1 million for Target and $1.2 million. They paid those in full in 2008. And then we take the installment contracts to the bondholders, show them, okay, these people have signed up. The bondholders know that that's golden under state law. They know that there's a first priority lien that's as high as property taxes, so they know that they will get paid initially, unless, of course, you hit the recession of a generation. Which, you know, becomes problematic for the city, as Mr. Honeycutt said. I guess the question that I would have is, even with the Dash 5 or Dash 6 amendments with this fairly major change, how are we going to go back 6 years? And I don't think that really changes the bond. In fact, Aaron mentioned that, and Harvey Rogers considered that too, because it's still too huge a question mark. You know, by the way, under Mr. Honeycutt's hypothetical, about $2 million, that doesn't change our obligation to the bondholders. That's still $6 million.
Yeah, one of the things, we talked a little bit about this. This is more perspective than anything else, but I am wondering about, in this process of deciding levels of assessment in an LID, how wide open to leave that to basically do some deal making to make the project happen, because you get into these things where, like, okay, you're the big guys, we need you, you're the anchor, that's what everyone wants to go there for, we need you, so we're going to do $1 million. Somebody's got to then kind of eat the cost of their stuff, and it seems like maybe, you know, I don't have my mind made up who that is, but it seems like maybe it's not the rest of the developers every time. Maybe that's, if the city really wants it and all the accompanying jobs and revenue, maybe the city has to pay it to make it happen. Because it's sort of awkward to shift it over onto other people unless they're definitely getting that new, like
that
in this case
amount.
Let's say it was $5 million. Mm-hmm. You got to hope that whoever paid that $5 million actually got $5 million worth of improvements, because you're not doing it by square foot or acre or anything. And so if they just took it on behalf of someone else, but they didn't really get it. Now, I know you have an appraisal saying they did get it on their property. I'm not talking about this case. I'm just saying, is there a chance right now in the system, when you're not going on an assessment multiplied across your land, to game it where people are saying, yeah, Target, Walmart, whatever, we need you. We need you in there, but, you know, it's a problem. It feels wide open right now.
Chair Clem, representatives of the committee, quite honestly, as a city manager, professional, sort of practitioner working in this field, there are pieces of that are enticing, in that limiting the amount of flexibility that cities have in negotiating terms of an LID could actually potentially be helpful to us. Mm-hmm. To be able to go to a developer and say, you know what, I'm sorry, but we can't reduce the assessment to these properties because law says it has to be even across the board by square footage, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think there's some room to talk there. At the same time, municipalities in this state have extremely few tools available to us to encourage economic development. Local improvement districts are pretty much the only one we have. We can't change property tax rates unless we happen to have a enterprise zone, which are no longer being doled out. You know, we have no sales tax to change. We can't issue star bonds and other kinds of things. Local improvement districts are really it. So on one side, there's some. I'm enticed by that concept because it would actually make it easier for us. On the other side, I'm a little nervous to start chipping away at and taking away and limiting the tools available to us, since we really, the tool belt only has one hole in it, basically. So, but I think there is some room for talk there in setting up the initial assessment, the rules around LIDs. That, however, does not apply to this situation.
That'll be a 2015 conversation anyway.
Yeah. So, thank you.
Any more questions for this panel? Okay, so we'll get the dash sixes out of LC. We'll put them on OLS. You know, Representative Thatcher's asked if there's a chance for another conversation. Seems to be some willingness to do that. We'll be back on Thursday. I've got no more folks on this hearing. So let me carry over the work sessions on House Bill 4015, House Bill 4017, House Bill 4029, and 4092. I might just say one thing for the record while Aaron's still here. We had another bill today that limited some city authority to go across the House floor. But, of course, the problem is people come to us, too. We're representatives as well. And they say, hey, these are the state laws somebody's operating under. So we don't think they're being applied fairly. And we need to be judicious when we intervene to change the whole system. But these are state laws cities are operating under, too. And these are, people who vote for me or not coming and saying, how did I get annexed, or how did I get into this LID? And that's why we engage in this, is I have to run for re-election, and people say, hey, I came to talk to you about a state law, and you told me that's the city's problem. And so I think that's why we start to delve into this. It's in response to constituents and or people, just like your city councilors do. And they always come in with, well, hey, 2222 is what the city's citing as the legal authority for what they're doing. Do you agree with them? And then I have to decide, well, yeah, I do, or no, I don't. And so anyway, that's more probably for Aaron on the annexation issue. You just happen to be right here. But you're welcome to comment on that.
May
yeah,
I?
Please. Yeah.
Chair Clement, I do appreciate that your buzzword is responsiveness. Our buzzword as city managers is efficiency, right? And we have to be efficient and effective. You have to be responsive to your constituents. What I would encourage the representatives to remember is to weigh the number of constituents you're affecting. So in this particular instance, you're talking about affecting one fairly small group of constituents who do not live or reside within a community, and impacting adversely 37,000 who do. So, it's something to weigh.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
thank you.
That's fair. Okay, and only 40 minutes late. With that, thank you all for sticking around, and I'm going to... I got everything done?
Got everything done.
Okay. I'm going to adjourn the...
make sure it's done right. We'll get one more option.
Yeah, no, this
one
is it.
All the bills are carried over from today, all the work sessions.
Okay. Nobody's bill died today, so everyone lives another day, and I'm going to adjourn the committee. Even Representative Banske is still.